This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this week's podcast. And boy, I have some fun for you tonight. One of my oldest and best friends in the comedy world is here, and he's brought two terrific friends.
You narrowed it down, not in the world. It's the comedy world. Well, you got a neighbor you like better than me?
I had to have some niche going here.
All right.
But ladies and gentlemen, we're doing a roundtable of talking about stand-up comedy here in Los Angeles, California. And that voice, if you don't recognize it, is from, as I said, a very dear friend. You may know him, but if you don't, you need to Google him and go out and watch his stuff. Because whether it's TV, movies, comic books, sitcoms, or whatever, Bruce Baby Man Bomb is in the house. Oh, Bruce. Yay.
So yeah, I'm glad they're only clapping and they've all got their masks on.
Yes. But not only
And there's
that.
Not even a pandemic. That's what's great.
And he's brought with him two very talented professional comics that I haven't had the pleasure of working with, but I'm so excited to have him here on the show. Ladies and gentlemen, Lang Parker is in the house.
Lang, thank you.
Thank you for
joining us.
Thank
you very much.
That's enough. She gets less. And
that was more. They were actually yelling for her. I only got applause.
And ladies and gentlemen, Mike Guido.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. So okay.
I'm here with Bruce.
I shortened the intros because Bruce is already taking control of the room. But it is a pleasure to have you all here. And I've had the honor of working with Mr. Baum for, 20 years on stage. And we've been friends for about 40 years. And just a terrific guy and stand-up comic. And as a friend, you have brought two terrific people. Lang, why don't you, Lang Parker, comedian, nominated for an Emmy Award. You've been very successful.
Right? I can say that.
Yes. Why don't you tell the audience just a little bit about how you got into comedy and why you picked this art form?
Oh, good Lord. Okay. I was moved out from Wisconsin to Los Angeles, got into improv, the Groundlings, and took improv classes. And this guy came up to me and he's like, hey, you know, you should do stand-up. And I'm like, I kind of knew what it was, but I didn't. And I'm like, yeah. And he was like, look, I put together shows at this old people's home in Fairfax. Come on down and just tell some jokes. And I'm like, okay. Had no clue. I didn't even know what I was going to do. So I get there, the room is packed of old people. It was awesome. And I get up there and I ate it. It was the worst. I brought a telephone with me and pretended.
Doing props?
Oh, God. Yes, because I didn't know what to do. I was, oh, my God. So I did my thing and I'm like, oh, I will. Left the stage and I'm like, I will never do this again, ever, ever. And this guy came up to me, goes, kid, keep doing what you got. You're great. You got great stage presence. And I'm like, thank you, sir. You're just so kind. And one of the people that work there come flying over to me and she's like, what did that man say to you? And I was like, he told me to keep doing it and I have great stage presence. She goes, you listen to that man. That was Milton Berle's brother. And I'm like,
Wow.
I'm like, I guess maybe I should keep doing this, but oh my God, it was terrifying. It was awful.
But what a great thing to hear just in your first time on it. Now, you are a lovely young lady, but approximately what year would that be?
Oh, Christ.
In the 90s.
I think it was in the 90s, early 90s.
All right. But, and that kind of, you got the bug.
Well, no, if he didn't say anything, I wouldn't have never done it again, ever. It was terrifying. But I'm like, well, Milton Berle.
So wait, we have Milton Berle's
brother
to blame, is what you're saying.
Right, yes, exactly.
It was 2 degrees of Milton.
Right.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, and then, by the way, if I may be so bold.
Yes,
you may be bold.
Yeah.
I got asked to teach an extension class at UCLA in comedy.
Yes.
And Lang took the class.
Yes.
No way.
Yeah. And I remember her specifically because she came up in a straitjacket. Am I right?
Yes, because I was petrified.
She came up in a straitjacket. And there was two people from that class. One of them ended up doing stand-up for a while. But he was an Orthodox. He was Orthodox Jew and didn't want to perform on the weekends or on. Back then, you had to perform
right
every night. Now you don't. Now you can pick and choose. You know, well, not everybody can, but you can sometimes. But so, and I did, after the class, I didn't see her for years, and then I did this gig. Where was Cedar Rapids or somewhere up in the mountains? It was some ski resort. Do you remember this?
Idaho Falls.
And she's on. I didn't remember her. I mean, she looked different.
Trust me, she remembered you.
Well, when she came, she says, "You know, and then I remembered her immediately. It was that gig was probably it was at a ski resort, and the show
was five?
Five o'clock. The ski lifts were open till six, so we're basically.
Good planning.
We were being paid pretty good money. And they flew us in and put us in a beautiful condo. And it was 2 or 3 days.
So the audience was just like people who broke their legs that day.
That's no, what I was going to say.
No, that would have been okay.
Yeah, right.
It was the bartender and the waitresses.
That was it. That was it.
There was everybody. As soon as, and we did the show. We actually stood there and did the show.
The show must go on.
Yes. Yeah.
And as we got off, here comes the flood of people. So if they had just delayed it like an hour or two.
You think they would have learned. But so you guys had a chance to not connect early and then reconnect later.
And then, years later after that, I filled in at that casino up in Oregon.
Uh-huh.
You were the one. I got the gig, and I didn't know you were on the bill.
Lincoln City.
Yeah.
Lincoln City.
And so, you said to me, do you remember me? I was in, and then boom, it came back.
And then we start talking about the Green Bay Packers, and your son loves them.
And then I got back, and I started working on a movie, and they said, "Do you know anybody that can play like with a Wisconsin kind of accent?" And I went, "Are you kidding me?" I just worked with what you're looking for.
Oh, that's
so funny.
So we did a movie together.
Yep.
Wow. Okay. So we'll get back to that.
Good
start.
Okay.
We've not let Mike join in.
Right.
Ladies and gentlemen, over here to my right, snoozing off.
It's a 5-hour show.
You've seen him on HBO, MTV, and Showtime. He is a terrific headliner.
Close.
I've had a chance to see some of his stand-up comedy. He's hilarious. This is Mike Guido. Mike, how did you kind of fall into stand-up comedy?
Oh my goodness. Or
were you following the path of Lang and taking classes from Bruce?
Well, a class was a part of my journey, but it all started, so I had this secret ambition. I grew up in upstate New York, small town, Monroe, New York, about an hour's drive northwest of Manhattan. And so I had this thing, but I couldn't tell any of my friends because they would just laugh me to scorn. So one time this friend of mine says, "I'm going to take you to Catch a Rising Star in New York City. We're going to an open mic." So we drive down there and I'm in the club in the audience and comic after comic, they're all eating it. Uh-huh. They're all bombing. And that's when I said, "I can do that." And there was no stopping me from then on.
That's confidence.
And then, I moved to San Francisco, which, of course, was the hotbed of the universe at the time for comedy. And I took Frank Kidder's How to Be a Comedian class.
Wow.
I don't know if you remember Frank.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And but it was there that I learned I could do this. I got some help from Frank Ergus. Remember Frank?
Of course.
Frank kind of took me under his wing a little and said, you can do this. And but my very first time on stage was the club in San Jose. I forget what it was called. I went to an open mic. First time on stage, I'm out there. And the first couple minutes, I'm getting some laughs.
Hey.
And I'm going, I'm killing this. This is so easy.
Was it the last laugh?
Yes.
Yeah, I helped them get started, and I'm glad that you had that experience. So what year was that, Mike?
I started comedy in 84.
All right, good. So you caught some of the wave. Yeah. Lang, you came across a little later.
Oh, yeah.
Now, when you got started, this is going to test your brain. I've already asked Bruce this, and he's already shared it. Oh, Bruce, I'm going to pass on you right now. What are your early jokes or bits? Something that you remember?
Oh.
Or what did you do with the phone?
Oh, I threw the phone away. But I did everything by it was basically a monologue in a straitjacket, just talking about how dating just sucked and guys are whacked and everyone else but is whacked except me, who's in a straitjacket.
Oh, that's funny. But you were, again, Bruce, we should have mentioned Bruce Baum, not only a terrific headliner, done everything, got his start and is really known and famous for being a prop comic. You went far beyond that in your career. But it's funny that you're teaching a course, you're a prop comic, and here's Lang doing her set in a straitjacket. But that's hilarious. And you're talking about dating and men and how the whole world's crazy.
Yes.
But you're in a straitjacket. So that also plays into your early trainings in improv.
But I think the straitjacket, wasn't it a police mandate?
She was... It was court ordered.
Yeah, court ordered. So Mike put you on the spot. Do you remember any early bits that you did back in New York when you went up on stage at Catch?
I didn't go on stage. I was just there in the audience.
You eventually did.
Well, that's another story. Letterman audition that went terribly awry. Bunch of years later.
We won't go there.
But I did this bit like that night at Laughs Unlimited in San Jose. It was Indiana Jones in a fight, if you will, battle against Darth Vader. And Darth Vader takes his lightsaber. He's and Indiana Jones, of course, just shrugs, pulls out his gun, shoots him. Shrug, you know, that like that scene from Raiders of the Lost.
So you were actually doing a bit of improv or a bit of a skit. It wasn't pure stand-up in the sense of a setup, punchline.
I guess so. I never thought of it that way, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Lang was doing kind of some early improv and use some props, and you were doing skits. Now, Bruce, I know that you started with prop comedy in the college days,
right?
And you've got a little more years experience on stage than these two young people.
Well, I used to be exclusively props. I mean, everything was a prop. Now I probably, if I'm doing a 45-minute set, maybe 10 minutes is props. If you know, they're interspersed. But, you know, the problem was when you start touring and you got a different sound and light person every night.
You can't trust the
– back in those days when you were in a club for a week, I'd say, look, I can work with any screw-up. You don't have to – don't freak if you make a mistake. But let's just get it right after a show or two.
We're all professionals, right?
But they would have somebody different every night. So that was like, so I said, you know what? I started writing stand-up, and I got just as big laughs. And I went, wow, I don't have to carry that 50-pound prop for 20 seconds when I can tell that joke. So I started writing more stand-up. And then I got hired even on television to write.
See, I thought you bought new props for every show.
Well, I was talking to – I did an interview with Mac and Jamie, some good friends. Oh, yeah. And they were talking about – they started off using some props. And they started touring. And they just forced themselves that anything we're going to use on stage has to fit in a briefcase. In other words, if it didn't fit in the briefcase, it was out of the act. And they had to rewrite a lot of their act. But I will say, Bruce, that as a testament to your humor, just driving down today, because Jill and I love what we did all those years, something happened and we were immediately doing the bit where you would pretend to hold a fly over the globe of the world and go, I'm too high! But, you know, so those the thing about prop comedy is, I don't know if it's easier, but it stays in your memory, I think, a little longer than maybe a bit. You know, you might do a joke.
And with Bruce, you know, Bruce and I have worked, like, a lot together.
Over the country.
Yeah. And by the way, he doesn't like to fly. We're, like, driving across the country. It's so crazy. Annoying. But whatever Bruce does, it's clever, you know? So whether he's using a prop or not, it's clever. It's the audience doesn't know what's coming, and that which makes things funny, of course. And it's all just, it's just clever stuff. You know?
Well, and then that's and I've already used the word, I'll use it again. It's a testament to his talent because he was able to.
Well, I won't go that far.
But he was able to bring the funny in different circumstances. And as Bruce alluded to, that even if things went wrong on stage, you were quick enough to turn it into something to entertain the audience. And that's really what the three of your goal was to entertain. So you've all been on the road for a long time. Real quick, we'll start with you, Bruce. Any road experience that really stood out that was either, you know, absolutely horrifying or absolutely amazing that to this day you'll go, oh, you know, that was so great or that was so bad because.
Wow. I'm trying to think.
Is this hard because there's too many?
No, I wouldn't say that. This is probably the most out of character thing for me.
Okay.
So it wasn't like it was really good or really bad. There's a buddy of mine, Jimmy Pineapple. He's a comic. He is a comic. He was, and he was from the Houston area. I believe he's living in Louisiana now. And he's he doesn't drink anymore. He was but he used to. I guess what would you say? A recovered alcoholic, recovering.
Right.
Yeah.
But he used to really. He was part of that outlaw group with Kinison and Andy Huggins and
pounding the drugs.
So
and the
I never really got drunk. Okay, I've always been kind of a pot guy. But the last night I played, God, I'm pretty sure it was Kansas City. We did the gig and then we went out drinking. And I woke up in L.A. and so when I did was flying. I had no luggage. All my props were not there.
Oh, that's scary.
That was before cell phones. So I finally got a hold of Jimmy, and Jimmy said, yeah, you left like a lot of your clothes in that first Denny's we were in.
Grand Slam will never be the same.
You know you're drunk when there's multiple Denny's in your night.
Yes. That's so funny.
And he ended up putting, I said, can you just put, because I used to travel with trunks.
Oh, I remember.
I said, you know, it was like I bought, you know, ZZ Top's Tres Hombres, you know, railroad set. Yeah, I just said, just don't even worry about how you pack it. Just get it in there. And
did they have the props then or were they at Denny's?
Yeah. No. I left some at the club, some in the condo, some in the restaurant.
So the message, young people, is careful how much you drink.
Well, I'm not a drinker also. So that was, it's not like I've got lots of, I don't drink as I have seen what it does, you know, to a lot. When the clubs first opened up, the comics got to drink for free.
Right.
So some of them did a lot of that before they hit the stage, a lot of them after, and they're not around anymore. So I saw that happening, and I've just, you know.
Well, and drinking is part of the thing. I mean, I as a club owner, I owned all these bars. I drank every night, but I had a rule. I would only allow myself to get drunk one night a year. It was New Year's Eve, and I always had somebody babysitting me. It was like an employee would be in charge of me to make sure I didn't drive or do something stupid. But early in my MC career, I went on stage drunk and I was horrible and just effed up in big ways. And I kind of learned my lesson early on. But, Lang, how about you? You've been on the road. Anything really stood out that was extra special fun or maybe kind of a nightmare like Bruce?
I was up in Montana, the closest, what is the city at the closest to Canada? Butte, maybe.
Maybe.
Oh, Butte, Montana? Okay.
Yeah. Well,
we'll go with
way
that.
Up, yeah,
we'll go with
something that. To way to the top. And the place you could not see to the other end of the place. It was just smoky. It was dingy. It was, I mean, it was very interesting. But anyway, so I did my set. And this guy, in the middle of my set, this guy stands at the right at the end of the stage and stares at me the whole, and I'm like, and I'm still kind of new and I don't know if I should address it or not. I mean, now I would, but I was just like, I was scared and he just kept staring at me and I'm like, and he just the whole through the half set all the way to the end. And then finally he just walked away. Later on, I go to the owner. I go, what was up with that guy? He's like, well, you see what
he's
happened?
He's blind.
No.
He forgot his glasses,
exactly.
Wanted to see you.
He said that this is a city that they let ex-convicts out and to get back into society. So that was a convict that was a prisoner that got out and he was just trying to get back into society.
Well, that's so nice to know that an ex-axe murderer was right in front
exactly,
of you.
Exactly.
And they were well prepared to take care of it if something went wrong.
Oh, no.
I was going to say, where's the bouncer, right? I
mean, no, there was no bouncer at this place.
I've heard nightmare stories. A couple comics, I've interviewed over 50 of them, have said, and been two or three of them that have said that one of their worst experiences was that at some point in the show, some drunk guy that's huge, you know, like a gorilla, is charging, you know, the stage. And a couple times they reach the stage and it wasn't pretty. Other times they get tackled and thrown out. But I mean, it is very intimidating. You're trying to entertain an audience.
Right.
And your job is to keep the focus. And that's kind of tough to do when someone's standing right in front of you staring at you.
Like a serial killer. It was just weird. He just would stare. And I'm like, I was so scared to address it. I just like, I'm going to go over to the other side of the stage and talk over here.
But
and
with then, experience, you probably would have managed it better.
Like, yes. Yeah.
Well, but then you call the prison afterwards and you say, look, the guy with the plaid coat tonight, he's not ready to come back yet.
Right. He needs to go back in.
He was mesmerized by me with a microphone.
You know, I had a situation right after I was part of a comedy team. And then I went solo. And the only bit that I did that we had together that I kept is I used to have that little chimp, you know, the clap.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Remember that bit?
They hit it at the top of the head. So I would sing Up the Lazy River or some song with it. And I'm playing it. This is before the Hermosa Beach Club even opened. So it was in Hermosa Beach. And the show's going great. And there's like a couple motorcycle guys and their chicks sitting in this like booth.
Oh, God.
And I get done with my set and I'm cleaning up my props and I come leaving. And the guy stands up. He goes, how much you want for the monkey? This guy's like 6'6", 300 pounds. I said, well, the monkey's not for sale. It's part of my act. He says, I said, how much you want for the monkey?
I'm thinking right now, when is my opportunity going to come in life where I get to say the words, the monkey's not for sale? That is so awesome.
Isn't it?
So I said it again. Hey, I said the monkey's not for sale. He said, I said, and I, at this point, I figure I'm either getting the shit kicked out of me, or I got to say something that scares him.
Oh, really?
So I said, you're fucking with the wrong guy. And he sat down.
No.
No.
Swear to God. And I was pissing in my pants.
But
and
you
shuffled out.
You took a tactic that not many would have the balls to do. But.
And I'll never do that again. You must have been, I'm batting 1,000 right now. I don't want to bat 500.
You must have been very close to that monkey.
The dumbest thing someone actually came up. Now, it was running on batteries.
Right.
So whatever speed it was at for that night, I went to. Someone said to me after a show, how do you get the monkey to go in rhythm with you? And they were serious.
Yeah,
and
they didn't
get it. Of
course
they were.
I said, we practice.
Well, Mike, you've been on the road for many years. Same question. Is there something that stood out that was really special or a little scary on the road?
No, thank you.
No monkey jokes? Come on. Yeah. No monkey jokes.
How much for the monkey?
You know what came to mind was one time I was co-headlining with Brian Haley. You guys remember Brian Haley? Went on to, you know, star in movies and so forth. Great guy. And we were pretty good friends. And we were bored. And we were like in Spokane, Washington.
Of course you were.
So we, right, where all things go bad. We decided one night, I don't know, we just decided to do each other's acts.
Oh, that's intriguing.
So it was very confused audience because I don't know if you remember, but Brian did this. Remember Max Headroom was his character in the 80s? Really white, chiseled face and chin with blonde hair. And Brian actually looked like that.
Exactly.
Cartoon character. So Brian would do this thing and lean into the microphone and make this sound like Max Headroom would do. And the audience would go nuts. Well, they didn't go nuts when I did it.
They're like, what is he doing?
And meanwhile, Brian goes up after me. First of all, while I'm on stage, he is just on the floor.
Yeah.
Because first of all, I'm doing his act wrong. And I'm dying. I'm eating it. So Brian's like rolling on the floor. The audience hates me. But then he goes up and tries to do my act, talking about my family and doing golf and baseball jokes and stuff like that, totally screwing it up. And I don't know. It never got back to the producers
that you did that.
We mailed one in.
It's a great memory now. At the time, what a scary thing to try, because I've seen a lot of comics and I've seen their acts a lot, but to try to emulate their entire set would be somewhat intimidating.
I probably wouldn't do something like that now, because now I'm more like morally astute. I guess 80s people paid money to see a show. I'm not going to do that. But
oh, waste their
I guess
time,
back
right?
then we just.
But
we
it's
just
a testament that you can't steal material.
Evidence. We have evidence.
And screw it up. Yeah.
Well, that, you know, I mean, all these stories are the kinds of things that make this industry so interesting, because it doesn't matter if you're, you know, shoveling burgers in a joint or doing a in court as a lawyer. And they all have their particular stories. But something about being on the road and being a comic exposes you to all these different audiences, all these different things. We were talking the other day about how you could have the most perfect set that you've practiced over and over and over, but it's going to be different if you perform that set Wednesday at 8 o'clock to 40 people and Friday late show to 120 drunk people. You can't do the same act the same way. If you're a professional, you have to find a way to present your material to fit the audience. And how many jobs that night after night after night do you have to take your skill and adapt it?
Seven. Or 1:15 a.m. in front of seven people at the Holy City Zoo.
Yeah, right.
But the reason that you start off and you have that wide breadth of audience, everything from that 1:30 audience, you know, in the middle of the night to a killer audience at 9, is that's what builds your comedy muscles. It's like lifting weights, you know, and so your muscles are prepared. Your comedy is prepared for these different situations because you've been through I used to go, if a heckler ever took me one line further than I had to deal with, I would go back and I wouldn't leave wherever I was till I had one more line. So a lot of lines you only use once a year on a heckler, once a year. But when you pull it out, it kills.
Right, right.
But well, if you only got one and they got two.
Because it's got to be the right spot and right, opportunity right. to do. You can't force
But that's
that,
where you learn, know? Doing all those gigs right. from 1:30 in the morning to that's where you build those comedy muscles. So you know what to pull out when.
And you're more relaxed. When you're more relaxed, I feel that you get the comebacks quicker. But if you start to panic, your mind goes blank and you're screwed.
Plus audiences pick up on that and then you're dead meat.
Yeah, they can sense the fear. And what you're talking about is the wisdom of the boards in the theater game and that experience over and over and over, being able to, without thinking, almost like a soldier that's being trained. They're meant, you know, follow this order, do this in this circumstance. And if you don't, you're dead. And in comedy, stand-up comedy, more so than, you know, acting, you get two or three takes. You know, singing, I guess you have to get it right, but, you know, still, if it's your song and you wrote it, you probably have it down. And how much can go wrong? But, I mean, in stand-up comedy, every audience is a different situation. I'm just trying
to
make...
Well, not if you're going to compare it to music. Music, you like a song the more you hear it. Comedy, the joke is less funny the more you hear it. So you got one at bat with a joke with an audience.
Well, that's actually very poignant and true.
I've always said, too, that someone, a singer or a band, I mean, they do their song, and when it's over, even if the audience isn't thrilled by it or really like it, there's still polite applause.
Oh.
With comedians, it's like every 7 seconds or so, moment of truth. Another 7 seconds, moment of truth. And that's why, and I think that's why we're tight-knit community.
Because you've been through the battle together.
Because no one else
together.
Knows what that's like.
But I think it's so great you mentioned that, Mike, because I've mentioned it before.
Me too.
Thank you. I've mentioned it before in the podcast that's one of the differences. From childhood on, we're trained that a musician, no matter how good or bad, you applaud.
Yeah.
It's like, well, they gave it an effort. You know, that really sucked. But, you know, they gave it a shot. That doesn't happen in comedy.
No.
If you suck, they let you know. Boom.
Or worse yet is silence.
Oh.
That's the worst. You know, you give a punchline and crickets, you got to react to that. And you got to fix it. And hopefully the next bit, you know, you start killing.
Well, with that in mind, let me shift it back to a question. So knowing what you know now with your wisdom on stage and your experience on stage, what do you know now that you wish you knew back in 94 or 84 or, you know, when you first started? Is there any gem that really would have made a difference in the your career path if you'd known it then?
Yeah, the monkey's not for sale.
Damn it. That monkey. Lang, is there something that that you think?
I would say not to just find that groove of just being calm.
The confidence.
The confidence and just being calm. That, well, that one didn't work. It get up.
But you know the next one will if you're experienced. Right. And when you're new, you don't know that.
No. And there's always the goal of trying to get that bed of laughter. I have never gotten that bed of laughter continuous. Obviously, I'm, you know, not a
but you don't want to let the you don't want to let the audience know that they're not laughing.
Right. You never insult the audience.
Yeah, you never let the audience know that you suck.
Right.
Let them figure it out on their own.
No, on the drive home. Yeah. On the drive home, you want them to
Well,
know
Bruce,
that.
You've had many years in the business, and you've gone on different adventures as a musician and an actor and producer and all kinds of things. But you're the most experienced in this room. What do you wish you knew when you started off in those college days that you, you know, take for granted now?
Which girls didn't have STDs?
Well, that might have changed the path.
Well, everything changed for Bruce when microphones were invented.
I don't know what I could have known then that would have helped me.
It's kind of like back then there was nothing to know because we were blazing the trail.
Yeah,
right?
We were all like, there was like 50 of us and everybody knew everybody and knew every gig. And that's not the way it is now. So the camaraderie you would have doing gigs back then, even if it was just for a week with somebody. Back then, you spent the week with them in a condo and you palled around. And those relationships kind of, you know, lasted throughout. You could see someone 10 years later, and if you had a good week together,
you remember it.
Yeah, you've bonded. And
well, I think that the relationships in this industry, the camaraderie that you know, that has been mentioned, that is shared because we've all been through the same battles. But Lang was talking about confidence. You know, I mean, Mike, you've done a lot of stage work. Is when you were just getting started, is it confidence or is it, you know, having that camaraderie, or was there something that you learned over the years that really made a difference, that would have made a difference if you'd known it in the beginning?
Oh, yeah, sure. And, you know, especially in the 80s in San Francisco, man, there was so much talent. So many of those people have gone on to be very successful actors and producers and writers and you name it. And there was a great family feeling camaraderie. I mean, we were kind of, you know, we competed with each other, but not to the point where it became a personal thing. You know, we would still root for each other on stage, you know, and that sort of thing. But
but going back to your other story, it is true that if you see your friend bomb, it's kind of funnier to you than it is for him at the time.
Well, back in those days, you would before there were agents, you know. You got gigs by being recommended by your friends. So.
Yeah, I'll tell you that, because this guy...
he's not pointing at Lang.
Bruce, we worked together. We did 2 weeks at Caesars in Lake Tahoe once, and that's where we kind of first met and worked together. Next thing I know, I get a call after we were finished, a week or so later, from the Comedy Magic Club in Hermosa Beach, a pretty, exclusive, but...
Definitely prestigious.
It's a great
prestigious
club.
Yeah. And they say, Bruce called us and said, you should work here. Or I don't know how they probably didn't work.
Yeah.
They probably worked.
Don't make me say it any stronger than that. But he should work there. You know what I'm saying?
But anyway, on his word.
You're going to find a horse head in your bed.
On his word, I got into the Comedy Magic Club, where I later worked with Jay Leno and stuff like that, you know. So Bruce did that for me. My very first headlining gig was in Kansas somewhere, because Dr. Gonzo, John Means.
Oh, right.
They called me. Hey, Gonzo was just here. He said, we should hire you as a headliner. I had never headlined before, but and I called him up. I said, "What do you do?" He goes, "You can do it. Oh, I know you can do
cool,
it."
Cool though. He had the confidence in you.
Yeah. So stuff like that happened, and but I want to say, as far as an approach that I maybe wish I had back then, but it takes time to develop this, like what you just explained, Lang, about that kind of confidence. And the way I've been now for the longest time on stage, I'm not saying I don't care. I care deeply about how I perform and if I earn the money they're paying me. Because I do mostly corporate gigs, well, before pandemic.
Right.
You know, they pay really well. If something doesn't fly, like corporate gigs, you could have all kinds of things wrong with the setup. Audience far away, lousy sound system.
Right, right. I mean, they're not comedy clubs.
This is not what they do. But I just make the best of it. And I laugh. And no matter what, it doesn't bother me. I have fun on stage every single time. Every single time. And that is contagious to the audience. They see that.
Excuse me for interrupting, but that's a learned thing that you wouldn't have known in the beginning.
No,
that
absolutely.
You're going to get through no matter what the situation. If the mic's bad, if the lighting's bad. I mean, we did shows at my club where during power outages.
Yeah.
And we would give the people in the audience flashlights and say, okay, shine them on the act. I mean, the show must go on. But you don't have that in you. When you're just starting, you have to learn that.
It's
something that comes along with time. So we've talked about how...
I did think of something, a lesson I learned.
Okay.
If I may be so bold.
Sure.
And that is, especially back when you were showcasing for The Tonight Show or Merv Griffin or back in the 70s, it was a big thing that they were in the club and you were part of the... And a lot of times they wouldn't show up. And that was like a big downer.
Right, big disappointment.
Okay, now this is a story. It's in one of these comedy books. And I'm Tom Dreesen, and I confirmed it. But as soon as I read it, I go, Tom Dreesen must have relayed this because it's exactly the way it went down. I was part of a comedy team, Baum and Esten. Right. Did I tell this on the other podcast?
Just that you had a comedy team.
I was a comedy team, Baum and Esten. And we auditioned for The Tonight Show the same night as Billy Crystal.
Oh, no.
Wait a minute. It gets worse. Billy Crystal and Tom Dreesen, okay?
Okay.
So as my partner was Ken Esten, we're first cousins, and he went on to a great writing career, won an Emmy. As we get to the club, every big wig in Hollywood is standing out in front of the Comedy Store. Norman Lear, Gary Marshall, everybody.
Why? Right.
Everybody.
The business is there.
Everybody from The Tonight Show, they're all out front. And we're going, oh, man, we're going to get seen by it. Anyway, we get inside, and they bought out the management for Billy Crystal, bought out the front half of the Comedy Store and made everybody stand out front while Tom and we went on. So we played to half a house, all in the back of the room for The Tonight Show talent coordinator. It was death. Now, as soon as we, because they didn't want anybody to see, they didn't want these guys to see
competing with Billy.
So we get done. Everybody files into the room. They introduce Billy. He destroys.
Wow.
And
the rest is history.
Yeah. Well, they called Tom in and said, we're going to give you another, we'll get you on the show. We didn't.
But boy, yeah, but that's one of those things that's like a true Hollywood story where everybody knows somebody, if not yourselves, being in the business this long, that this industry, it can chew you up and spit you out in a minute. It is a lot of times I talk about the acts that we all know that I call getting the golden ticket, where something happened. And it's always based on talent, most cases, but something happens and they get that sitcom or they get that movie or they get something. It doesn't happen to very many people. It's a very, very, very short list. This industry can be really difficult on somebody's confidence and career. I mean, we could all probably name somebody that spent 20, 30 years on stage and never felt like they got that. Even that chance. Now they might have gotten a chance, but it didn't go anywhere. And they're pretty bitter now. I mean, it can destroy some people. But okay, go ahead, Lang.
But doesn't it also, not all the time, but when you end up getting somebody that says, you're not going to make it in this business, and they take and go, oh yeah. And then they come back even harder and they become who they are. I want to know those people. Do we know any? Do you know anybody like
who
that?
They said you're never going to make
exactly.
it and they came back?
I mean, we got, you know, Lucille yeah. Ball as an actress, but, you know, is there any stand-ups
well,
that we know?
I'm sure that a lot of people were told in the beginning, you know, just stop. You're yeah. not going anywhere.
Right.
And they look, when I used to go to the Comedy Store on dates before I ever thought I was going to be a comic. And I remember seeing some guys there who ended up being very good, who, when I saw them, said to myself, don't they have any friends that will tell them, why are you doing this? Right. But, you know, some guys need to be bad before they're good.
Right.
Right. Right.
Not everybody.
Yeah. No, not you, Bruce. or the monkey. But so let's take this and spin it around. So you've all been in the business a long time. You've got a chance to work with a lot of people. Lang, I'll start with you. Is there anybody in the industry you got a chance to work with that really helped shape your career, or that you were really learned something from or in awe of that you wouldn't have been able to do if you weren't in comedy?
Go ahead. Because
Mike seems ready.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
His answer is going to be Bob Gibson.
He taught me how to throw a fastball at somebody's head. Oh, my goodness. One time at Cobb's, when it was on Chestnut Street, the original Cobb's Comedy Club in San Francisco, of course, I idolized Robin. Okay. And being in San Francisco back then, Robin was always around. You know,
oh, he would hit every
stage.
Club.
It was
in a night, yeah.
And he's obviously, when people today ask me about, you know, you knew Robin, what was he like? And I'll just tell him, you know, have you read and heard stuff about Robin? How awesome he was? And they'll go, yeah. I go, that's it. It's true. That's anyway. So, I mean, I was just a middle act. I got to do a set at Cobb's that night, and I did like 25 minutes just playing the crowd. It just worked out that night. I did like no material and I kind of killed.
Right. Having fun with the crowd.
I didn't know Robin was there. But after the show, I'm sitting outside and I feel someone sit up next to me and I look over and it's him. And
wow.
I would have shat myself.
And I never forget what he said. He goes, "Whoa, you were really riding the wave tonight, huh?" And I went, "I guess so." And he went on to tell me how most people can't do what I just did. And it's, if you keep doing that, you know, you're going to stand out and all this stuff. And I'm thinking, am I in heaven? I mean, what? This was amazing. Yeah. And so, he gave me that confidence from then on. Like,
that's a great story.
Yeah.
Well, and Robin was such a powerhouse in this industry, in this art form, that him just hitting my stage a couple times made me feel blessed. But getting words of confidence after him seeing your set, I mean, that I can understand why you still remember that. I mean,
plus it was when I was playing the crowd the whole time. That's what he noticed. It wasn't my material or any. It was, and what that was what he was great at. So I was like the guy I look up to the most. Just. Verify
that's like
me,
Babe Ruth, you know? Saying, "Hey, good at bat."
Yeah, right. Yeah,
you know that's amazing. Lang, you had a little time. Is there anybody that really made a difference in your life, or you enjoyed working with?
Well, Bruce.
Aww. Your mentor.
Yeah, because we banter material back and forth as we drive to the gigs, and just that always helps to have that camaraderie. How do you say that word? Thank you. I can't even say
part
it.
Of the community. Well, he was both of you. Everyone here said how important the community is, and you were blessed to get Bruce as part of your
exactly because I've been with
early on.
I mean, headliners that you're just like, ugh, you just you know you're the opener or the feature. You know it.
Yeah, they
and
make
they
sure.
make sure you know it. I'm like, I don't need to be hobnobbing it, but I want to learn. So I'll shut up and I'll observe, but. Man, there's some people that will make you.
Well, I've been plugging my book. I just came out with a book and 20 questions about answered about being a stand-up comic. And one of the things I talk about is watch other acts.
Yeah.
There's always something you can learn.
Always.
Even if they bomb, you're going to learn. If you're paying attention, it's a learning moment. But we've had two people here with two great stories. But Bruce, you're somebody's mentor, but you've had a lot of great people you've had a chance to work with. Who did you really learn something from?
You know, one of my favorite comics of all time. I'm just going to go. I mean, everybody considers Pryor and Carlin, as I do, and Jonathan Winters probably is the triumvirate if there's a Mount Rushmore. I was a real big Dick Shawn fan.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
He had probably he was one of the first ones to do a one-man show. It was called The Second Greatest Entertainer in the Whole Wide World. And it was before they were filming him, and he's passed. So it was phenomenal. When you walked into the show, it was set up like his office. And there was just a pile of papers. It was before computers. Like, he started writing and threw it down. When the play started, he was laying under those papers while everybody was getting seated. He came up from out of the papers. And then I got to be, they did a Dick Shawn special that took the place of Saturday Night Live for one Saturday night. And this is back in the early days, Howie Mandel and myself, before, you know. So I got to work with him for a week.
Oh, cool.
And he was already one of my, Tom Waits was on the show. So, yeah, Dick Shawn, George Carlin, I got to be friends with.
Oh, man, that's amazing.
So, yeah, and back in those years, Pryor was around a lot. You know, you could watch him at the comedy store. That was something. And Richard Pryor would walk in when he was working out a new set. And the first night he would just talk, just ideas. And whatever got a titter, the next night he concentrated on just a little more. And then a little more the next night. And what else got... By the end of the month, he had a whole new set. Now, that's something when you're watching, you go, yeah. I don't even know... Maybe Carlin can do that, but I don't know anybody else that would have the balls to go up there and go, I really don't know. I got no jokes. I'm just going to talk and see what's interesting.
Yeah, but he was able to work it night after night and develop it into an act, a set. And he was comic genius. No one's going to argue that. And for you as a young comic to be able to experience that, and were smart enough, and I bet there were other comics that are off drinking or womanizing, whatever they were doing to stay busy, you were paying attention. That had an impact on you.
Well, when Pryor was on stage, everybody was in the room.
Okay, okay. So. Well, my point is that it was of you to learn.
But he was basically a professor to everybody there, because he was up there without a net, you know, although she showed up once in a while.
Funicello?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, now there's an inside bit there I don't know.
Yeah, I would say Dick Shawn. And then watching Pryor and Carlin.
Yeah. You got a chance to work with some of the masters.
And Jonathan Winters. That's incredible. Because that's the improv side. I think a lot of comics maybe don't think of him when they say, who's your favorite comic? Because he was so improv-oriented. But I think he influenced a lot of comics.
Well, and let's be honest, you're also bringing up people that – we're doing this art form really before the huge comedy wave. Let's be honest. Yeah, well, we're talking the 60s, 70s.
They were kind of defining what the art form even was.
Exactly. You know? So you were getting an opportunity to work with these people before. See, I always I opened my club in 1980, and I feel like I just caught the wave at the right time and wrote it, you know, into the 90s, and then by the 2000s, I got out. But I felt blessed that I was able to ride that wave as a producer. As a comic, the people you're talking about had an influence on the industry and the art form, as Mike said, back in the 60s and 70s when it was still being developed. And for you to get a chance to experience that is something that somebody like Lang and Mike would not have had that opportunity, because by the time they came along, those guys were long done.
But if you go back, you know, even a half generation from there, you know, there was only like 20 comics, right? You saw Woody Allen, Jackie Vernon, Jackie Mason. There was like, you know, Bob Newhart, Jose Jimenez, Bill Dana. My parents never had music albums. It was always comedy albums.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's cool.
All comedy albums.
So you'll learn from that. Cosby's album.
Right. And you just kind of ingested it. It was like osmosis. They didn't know they were raising a comic, because back then comedy wasn't an option. Matter of fact,
wasn't a job, right?
Well, they did a survey recently on the most depressed professions there are, and it's usually dentists. Dentists usually lead the list.
Toll booth workers.
But about a year ago, comics came in number one.
What?
Yeah, comics is the most. And I put up on the thread that I said, this is good news, because when I started, we weren't even a profession. the fact that we're a profession and we're depressed is a move up.
There you go.
But that's so true. Yeah. I mean, I've told the story a couple times on the podcast, but people that are young now and weren't around in those days, and I was a kid back in those days, stand-up comedy was the break between jazz bands or the entertainment between strippers. I mean, really, other than the Catskills and maybe the Hungry Tiger in San Francisco, it was strip clubs and jazz clubs.
I'm pretty sure Jay Leno told me once that that's how he started strip shows.
Yeah. I mean,
who's the comic?
Oh, that's funny. I've seen Leno in a Speedo, I guess.
Somebody named Bubbles Morant.
But it is true that it, as Mike alluded to, it wasn't an art form. It was just coming, you know, the genesis was coming out, you know, the first creatures coming out of the sea. Comedy was just coming on. And then you were able to partake in that. And I think that you were very blessed with that, Bruce, and probably why you're so funny and why you've had the great career. But I came along a little bit later, but Lang and Mike came on in after that. So their heroes, the people they got to see, was really the generation of that wave, where you got a chance, and I think that's amazing, to interact with the people that started the wave.
Yeah.
You know, you guys got to surf it, but who are the guys that made the action, made the wave start? That's the end of my analogy. I'm sorry.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah.
But so let's kind of wrap things up. So I'm going to start with you, Lang. For everybody in the audience, Lang Parker's a very successful comedian. She was nominated for an Emmy for her set on Last Comic Standing. She's done some writing and been seen on The Ellen Show and Beverly Hills 90210. You definitely made a career in this. Is there anything that you want to share with the audience that you took away from your career in stand-up comedy, or anything you want to plug coming up means something that you're excited about in the future of your career?
And that answers it. No,
I was waiting for the Jeopardy music.
Right.
She did it in less than a word.
What was the question?
What did you have for lunch?
Yeah.
Okay.
What are you looking forward to? Is a successful? You've already made yourself this career. Where are you going?
I'm getting more and more into commercials and the acting part of
She's
it.
She's a great actress.
Thank you.
Oh, I didn't know you acted too. Besides.
She's been in several movies.
And lots of commercials. And right now I have been riding a wave of just getting some parts, and they're great. They're small, but they're compact with comedy. And because I was on stage and doing improv, I believe that has helped me land as much as I have.
Well, that's exciting, Lang.
By having that.
Yeah, you are starting your own new wave. Sam, back to the analogy. In your career, though, you're taking stand-up comedy, what you've learned, what you've developed in the art form, and you're moving into a new direction with the acting and stuff. That's amazing. That's exciting. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's great. Mr. Guido, this guy is not only a terrific stand-up comic and headliner, he's a big corporate guy. You do a lot of corporates. You already mentioned that there's a lot of money in it, which is nice. But it's also, you have to have the right attitude and the right comedy to do corporate. You have to be able to fit some of the information about that company into your material so that they're brought in. You bring the audience into your set, but also you have to be clean in most cases and stuff. But you've done much more than that. As I mentioned earlier, HBO, MTV, Showtime, you have your own set on Dry Bar Comedy, right, Mike?
Yep.
Yeah, so anybody out there, if you want to go check out Mike Guido, go to Dry Bar Comedy. And you've got a CD out, Who Needs Sanity, right?
That's right.
And that's probably available somewhere.
In my closet.
In your closet. Okay, so get a hold of Mike. And then we can't talk about you and your career without at least mentioning the importance that your daughter has played in your life and what that's meant to your career. For everybody in the audience, he's got a lovely daughter, Maria. She's lifelong been dealing with autism, and that has led Mike down the path of supporting the cause and raising money and paying raising attention to this dreadful disease. And I just, as a parent, let me just say that God's shining on you, that you're able to deal with all that. And what has all this meant? And of course, I'm not talking about Maria. I'm talking about what stand-up comedy has done for your life and where is it taking you?
Okay. Well, what I take away from my career in stand-up comedy, and I like to say, I say this to comic friends that I've known over the years, that we just go, man, we had a great run. Wow, so many. I mean, I'm sitting with two people who I had great experiences with.
Oh, thank you, Mike.
You know, three now.
We should say he was pointing at Bruce and Lang. No, I get it.
Three now. But man, so many, the big venues or the small venues and the experiences and the incredible people that career in comedy is that allowed me to be with and have experiences with. So now, yeah, I do corporate gigs when I can get them. And also now it's not just you have to be clean, but they're so afraid now if even one person is slightly offended by the material I do on my daughter, Maria, who has severe low functioning autism. I've been turned down because they're just so worried someone will take it the wrong way.
You're kidding.
Even though I preface it with, whenever I do that material, I say, my daughter, Maria, we love her so much. She's the center of our family, et cetera, et cetera. And I have applaud if you love someone with autism. And they do. And then I talk about experiences that we've had with Maria in public, usually, because it's hilarious.
Right, right.
You know, it's hilarious when she takes her shirt off at the table because she got a couple drips of water on it. And, you know, and I say, in the Guido family, we're just shoveling pasta while our dinner guests are aghast, you know.
Oh. Is your half-naked daughter sits there? Yeah.
You know, from my dry bar comedy special, they did a clip of my material on Maria alone, and it's over almost 4 million views.
Oh,
but
man,
in comments,
amazing.
Sometimes you see people, what a dirtbag, making fun of his daughter. I'm like, where have you, are you kidding?
But see, that's on
but
them.
But anyway, right. But corporate America now is so afraid of any of that. But anyway, that's my passion these days. I do a one-man show. It's called The Maria Effect. And it talks about, it's a make them laugh, make them cry thing. I've literally had men with tears in their eyes after this show. And boy, one thing I learned is, yeah, making people laugh is really cool. But making people cry, wow, really powerful. So they laugh and they cry. But that's my passion, telling that story. And how
you have
Maria,
to tell that to my wife when she starts.
And how Maria has affected my life for the better.
But but I think what I was getting to was and
can we not be serious, Bruce?
I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry. I tried not to say that.
but it goes back to that stand-up comedy was not only able to provide you a livelihood and a career, and you've been very successful, but now, not now, but in the dealing with the raising of an autistic daughter, being able to share that with the world, make people aware, help raise money to fight these kinds of diseases. What I was getting to is that this art form gives in a lot of different ways, and everybody has a different experience. And for you, it's presented you a vehicle to share and establish a rapport with a bunch of strangers about a personal situation that benefits the world. And I just think, Mike, that's really important, and you need to understand, and I think you do, how important that is, and thank you for sharing.
Oh, thank you. Totally my pleasure. My pleasure.
And we got to come back to my buddy, Bruce. And
why?
But I want to share because I've had the pleasure of doing so many.
I should
many
put that on like all my posters. Why?
Just why?
Why? Yeah. This Saturday night. Why?
Why?
Or, hey, why not?
I was once doing a press event. I had Pat Paulson at my club, and we pretended he was running for mayor. There was a mayor's race going on, and we had a whole thing at the Capitol with Pat Paulson. And the placards that we gave everybody in the audience said, "Why not Paulson?"
Right.
You never know. Sorry, I went on a side story. You brought up something. So, ladies and gentlemen, so proud to have him in this room and doing this roundtable. But my very good friend, and we've had a chance to share on many of these things, but let me share with the audience just a few things. Not only a tremendous prop comic and stand-up comic, and he's kind of famous for the role of Baby Man, which you got to see to believe, but he's a musician. He had a song, Marty Feldman Eyes, do very well. I was happened to be in part of the production of the video on that. On television, you've seen him actually as himself on The Simpsons in Cartoon World, and that's amazing. But he's also been seen on Full House, Northern Exposure, lots of talk shows, incredible history in television. He's been in the movies. He was in the movie Shakes the Clown, and he's got a couple books out. If you get a chance, pick up Letters from a Nut. I'm very lucky to have signed copies of both editions. You are a very established entertainer. And not only a good friend and terrific comic, but share with the audience just briefly, and that's not easy for Bruce. how did stand-up comedy take you to these many, I mean, an author, musician, TV, acting, stand-up? I mean, it's amazing.
Let me just, if I can, people need to know that for the Simpsons thing that Bruce did where he played himself, he actually took supplements that actually turned him into a cartoon. No one's done that.
Yeah.
Nobody.
That's commitment, damn it. But Bruce, I mean, a lot of these things wouldn't have happened if you didn't go down the art form of stand-up comedy.
Yeah, it was stand-up. You know, when I started, like I said, there were like 50 or 60 of us. And you kind of had the feeling, hey, we're all going to be comics our whole life together. And then the comedy boom happened, and we can get into how that happened, but other things shot off. Guys that you thought were going to be comics became writers on TV shows, and they went up the ranks to produce, and other guys went on to direct, guys like Mike Binder, Steve Odekirk, you know, other guys. They went off and did, but it was afforded by comedy. You got into offices from your comedy, you know, into meetings. And from there, it was up to you to like try to say, because I got at Fox, I was making short films for like 2 years, and then at ABC.
Yeah. But what you're saying is stand up comedy opened some doors.
Yeah.
That if you, well, if here's, you didn't have let me tell that
you
experience.
Why. Let okay. me tell you why, if I may.
You
I'm
may.
I'm going to. It doesn't matter whether I may. Like we were talking about with music, you get that applause every 3 minutes. And if a guy from A&R is in the back of the room and isn't that crazy about you, he can go, he did okay, but I don't want to sign him. But if you're in a comedy club, even if you don't like the guy, and he's getting killer laughs every 7 to 10 seconds, you can't deny that. So that I was actually started out as a singer-songwriter. But it seemed with comedy, because the reactions were so much, so fast, that somebody couldn't deny you were what you were trying to do.
And I'm just going to add to that. It's the reaction's more real because, as we said, with music, we're trained right. to applaud whether they were good or not. In comedy, it's a true reaction from a room full of strangers.
Now, I don't know if I said this on the other podcast, but the moment that changed me from singer-songwriter to comic, I was playing in the San Fernando Valley at a place called the Whole Earth Marketplace. It was basically a place where people had different booths during the hippie time, and you could buy beads. And then they had like an organic restaurant called the Good Earth Restaurant, I think it was called. And I was doing folk music, my original songs and a couple of Van Morrison and Neil Young kind of things. While I'm performing, and there's only maybe 7 or 8 people in the place.
Right.
Two dogs walk in and start mating
in
front of me.
No.
And I mean, they got tied. I don't know if you know what tied means, but they're like ass to ass. They're like, and I stop, the place goes silent. And I went, you know, this pisses me off. They know they're not on till after the juggler.
And your first bit of improv.
And yeah, and the place busted up. And
all 7 people.
All 7 people. I went, wait, that was... I felt good.
Yeah.
It was either that or their drugs kicked in.
Well, Lang had mentioned
it's either
it
that or go home with two new pets.
Well, Lang mentioned it earlier that there is something about the adrenaline rush, the feeling you get when that wave of laughter, that wave of approval comes over. And so many of the industry that we know are insecure, shy, you know, intimidated people that were brave enough to go on stage. But when they get that love from the audience and they get that adrenaline rush from that first big laugh, I mean, it's addicting, right? You want to repeat it. And so that was, so for you, it was two dogs. And the monkey came a lot later.
I've always been animal oriented.
Maybe the dogs inspired the monkey.
Yeah. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this has been a fun comedy roundtable. I want to thank my guest, Lang Parker, Bruce Baum, Mike Guido for being here. We hope you enjoyed listening to this as much as we enjoyed doing it. Everybody, thanks for coming out.
Thank you.
Is this when you tell us about the parting gifts?
Yeah, yes. We'll have parting gifts in just a few minutes. We want to thank you for joining us. And don't forget, next week we'll be back with another great show. I got to do it because Bruce is here. But ladies and gentlemen, Lang Parker, Mike Guido, and Bruce Baum. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Be sure to tell your friends. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, and our sponsors, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.